The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Let's have a word of prayer.
Father, thank you for this time together, for the challenges that you place before us by our being together and our sharing with one another, the opportunities we have of learning from the things that you've taught us by your Spirit. Now teach us how to serve you with our hearts and minds, and teach us, O Lord, how to be sensitive to others and where people come from. Grant this for Jesus' sake. Amen. I want to mention a couple of books that I suspect you haven't yet come across here. Both of these deal with communication theory. The first one is by Charles Kraft. It's called Communication Theory for Christian Witness. If I had my druthers, you would not be allowed to go through the first semester at Westminster Seminary without reading this book. I suspect you will graduate without looking at it. Charles Kraft. It's published by Abington Press. And the publication date is 1983. The other book I want to mention to you, and I don't know if some of you have seen this one either, is called Contemporary Christian Communications by James Engle. Jim Engle is a professor of communications in the graduate school at Wheaton College. One of the difficulties of this book is that it's a paperback. It is not a paperback. It's published by Thomas Nelson and Sons, and the price on it is $12.95. Borrow the copy out of your local library. But someday I hope this thing gets into paperback. It takes about 2 or 3 years before publishers get rid of their first edition like this, and then they put things in paperback. I guess the reason I want to mention both these books is that, generally speaking, people get through an institution like Westminster and learn very little about communication practices. And in a real sense, preaching and teaching and sharing are communication skills. The advantage of these men and these kinds of books is that they wrestle with those kinds of questions, and then you get some fallout in terms of preaching in other areas. But I find these things extremely helpful. Some of you may know the name of Kraft. He is a professor of missions at Fuller Theological Seminary. And about 79, he wrote a book called Christianity and Culture, which is still, I think, probably the kind of book to deal with in terms of questions of the gospel and culture. This book came out about 3 or 4 years later. It uses a lot of Kraft's earlier ideas, only it's much more readable. For example, here are some of the topics in the chapters. How does meaning happen? The vehicles we employ. What keeps people from misinterpreting more often? How does an effective communicator operate? Communication for life change. Kraft is a professional in the area of communications. And so what he's done is to sort of take some of these ideas and apply them to Christian communication skills. But I think a lot of good stuff here. It's the kind of book that I think every preacher definitely ought to read and have. Engels' book focuses not just simply on the question of preaching, etc., but deals with how to do it book in terms of how to make use of communication and marketing skills in order more effectively to use our human responsibility in terms of preaching the gospel. I've put that as theologically as I can, since I know the type of people you all are. But Engel is not a professional theologian. He was converted, I think, in New York during the Billy Graham Crusade, and he spent his whole life in marketing. He's probably one of the, until his conversion, he was known throughout the country. He was one of the 10 or 15 top marketing specialists in the United States, taught for many years at Ohio State University. And then he was saved at the Graham Crusade, and now has taken a lot of those marketing skills and put them to use in terms of how to make use of this for gospel communication. I think most around here, a lot of kids generally read somebody like Engel and say, "Ah, well, look at the way he exegetes Proverbs 1:4, you know." get all of that out of your system once you read him, and then proceed to read in terms of what you can learn, because I think there's a great deal of profit in a couple of these books. And generally, theologian types and pastors, budding theologian types, don't read in some of these areas. It's maybe some small heresy, but one of the smaller ones that I come out with. But I think probably if I had my druthers and was teaching a course in homiletics, I would not ask you to read books on how to prepare sermons. I would demand that you read books like this, because they deal in many ways much more effectively with communication questions. The other stuff you can pick up in the coffee break. Anyway, I want to mention those two books just to get you thinking about some of these areas. There's another book that is published by, I'll mention too, by Dave Hesselgrave, who's a professor at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. I do this because we have a professor here with us, and I got to get brownie points. When he leaves the room, I'll really tell you what I think of this book. It's a nice book. It's the cover's pretty, and there's a lot of good sermon illustrations, and the price is reasonable. Now, is there any other thing I can add? It's called Communicating Christ Cross-Culturally. It's published by Zondervan, and I think that date also is 79. It's Dave Hesselgrave, if I remember right, has got his degree, his PhD, in communications, speech communications, from the University of Minnesota. So he brings a lot of the technical know-how into this kind of question. And where its value, at least for me, is he's dealing with not just simply communicating Christ, but he wrestles with the cross-cultural dimension. And there are not many people that are doing that. So that the book has value for that. I think it tends to be kind of theoretical and difficult then at times to really transpose into how to do it kinds of experiences. And that's the virtue of Kraft and Engel's book. They're more on the how to do it side than this one is. But still, those you've got some good choices to make in terms of communication skills nowadays. When we deal with a question like communication and being aware of the kind of folks out there and how we're going to work with them, we're dealing with a number of extremely difficult topics. But I want to try and give you see if I can come up with a couple of illustrations that will make this thing relevant. Most of my illustrations this morning are going to be taken from the area of cross-cultural examples, but I think we can we can make transpositions fairly easily. Some of us who have worked in a black inner city setting wrestle with the problems of gospel communication on one level. As whites, it is very difficult to communicate to blacks, and very difficult as well for blacks to communicate with whites. Why? Well, our immediate answer is racism. And that's a part of the picture, a part of the puzzle. But it is not all, and sometimes I think not even the most significant part of the puzzle. The problem is we're dealing with two different cultures. And when you deal with two different cultures, what we're dealing with are two different ways of communicating and passing messages back and forth across the line. And here's where the racism comes in, it seems to me, on the white side. Because the white assumes that since the black speaks English, and since the black is here in the United States, therefore there are not two cultures, there are only one. Or he assumes that there should be only one, and naturally assumes it should be white. So the communication then begins to fall down the frustration begins to build when people find themselves not being able to communicate across those lines. And the difficulty, to my mind, is just simply that we're working with two different cultures. Small illustration. Not too long ago, Francis Schaeffer, a few years back in Moody Monthly, had an article, and it was titled like, "Why We Can't Understand Our Children." And it was a nice Francis Schaeffer-type article. And the Moody Monthly publishes those things. And if you stay long, those of you who are in the demon listening to me for the first time, if you stay long enough, don't worry, there will be something in these lectures to offend everyone. But Fran was dealing with the question of why parents can't understand their kids nowadays. And the point that he was trying to make is that the reason parents are having a hard time is because in the meantime, a new culture, he was arguing, is developing from the ruins of an old one. And the parents, still living in the old cultural world, can't make the transition. They can't cross over and are having trouble relating to their kids. And the problem is compounded because there's only one generation. There's two generations here. And so says Fran, it is not a question simply of a generation gap. In the meantime, what has divided these people are two different or distinct cultures, one of which is collapsing and the other is being built out of the ruins of the old one. So people can't cross over the line between these two cultures. And that's why parents can't understand their kids. I think these are part of the struggles that we're trying to deal with in terms then of defining culture. I've been teaching a Sunday school class at 10th Presbyterian Church for about a month and a half now on the Bible and women. And the class is about, how many in the class now? I don't know, but I would guess probably about twice as many as in this room. And I have taught this course before at a couple of other places, and only this in this instance it's very different. In all of the times where I have taught this course, in churches that I would categorize sociologically as sort of blue collar, where most of the women are housekeepers, housemakers. And they are not, and they don't have jobs outside the home. Usually, when the course begins, we get people sort of thinking about this question by asking them a set of questions, which then is kind of free throw discussion for the first hour of the first session of the class. What are some of the problems that you're struggling with in connection with this question? And then people sort of create their own agenda that we're going to study over the next few months. The questions that I get from that congregation are almost always questions that are related around family-type problems. Somebody wants to know about how to, husband-wife relationships, or responsibilities in the home towards the children. What do we do about if we've given the possibility of a wife working outside the home? Those are the kinds of questions I get within that setting. And so the course finds itself sort of being oriented around those types of questions. When I taught at 10th Church, the first class session, I asked those kinds of questions, and I started jotting down the answers. And it was really interesting, because I had a totally different set of agenda items when it was all done. 10th Church, or at least those, by and large, those who are attending my class are what are called now yuppies. They are the young urban professionals. The preponderance of people attending the class are women. And the questions they're all asking are questions relating to conflicts they are feeling in terms of their jobs in relationship to their homes, and their jobs in relationship to the churches, for example. One young woman is a business executive in a large firm in downtown Philadelphia. She is the manager on her particular floor. She has approximately 20 to 25 people working underneath her. She's in her upper 20s. She is frustrated. She says to me, in my job, I'm important. It's expected that I be aggressive and active and somebody who controls. She says, then I come to 10th Church on Sunday morning and the expectations change 360 degrees. It's expected that I'm to be passive. I'm to be static. I can't even take up the collection in my own congregation. She's considering leaving the church. And her conflict comes then between the role expectations that she has to fulfill on her job and then what she's expected to fulfill in the church. And she's got conflict. Somebody else struggles with what do I do with my gifts? Somebody else in the congregation, a woman, happens to be extremely gifted a processor, a computer. No, that's not a programmer. Anyway, she's real good with those little things. And she's got a master's degree in programming. She's working in the development of programs for a high-tech organization in the Philadelphia area. She has one child, and she's now pregnant. And she's wrestling with how to balance off her requirements, her obligations at home, with her responsibilities at work. She also, she says, has a husband who expects her not only to do this, who encourages her to do this work and to use her gifts, but then leaves with her all of the obligations that traditionally are put on women when they come home. So she's expected to cook the meals when she gets home. She's expected to do the wash, take care of the family obligations, do the shopping, etc. And she's terribly frustrated, in a real bind and agony. Now, I raise all those things just to indicate that the issue is the same in a sense. It's what the Bible says about women. And yet the agenda items are radically different. Why? Because there are two different cultural sets of ways of looking at the issue that I'm facing with, that I'm faced with when I walk into those two different kinds of churches. All right, how am I going to handle them? And that's part of what we want to talk about here. Is that making sense to anybody? I guess part of what this is saying, and I hope you'll all jump in. We've got lots of all kinds of folks here from the DMIN who've got all kinds of umpteen tons more expertise in this area than I do. But I think where the big struggle comes, or I sense it, is that when it comes to cross-cultural stuff, when it comes to you having to move out of your language group into which you've been acculturated through your life, then cross water or mountains and move into another cultural group and use another language, that you can understand. That you can very quickly assume to be a cultural transition. You've seen all those John Wayne movies. You know the difficulty he has learning Navajo. It's different. You know it's different because the language is different, quote unquote. But the difficulties we're talking about are difficulties you will encounter even without the language differences, or even without those radically different language groupings. We're talking about how to communicate in a meaningful way to people within your cultural setting who have come out of a different cultural bias or approach or look. That's the kinds of things we're talking about. Carl?
Just an illustration, Ken. You're comparing the culture of this class at Kent with the blue-collar church, but yet you're also comparing two different cultures within Kent, that of the in the home, what's expected in the home and in the church, with what's expected out in the church.
Yeah, that's true. One of the yesterday morning in the class, one of the women had raised a question about in terms of some of these biblical passages we've been studying. How do we look on the question of who raises the kids, and who has major role responsibility in the home? And then another lady in the class, who's contributed a great deal, said, "Aren't we getting off base here? Let's not get this whole class bound down to just questions about how to raise kids." She said, "I'm a single woman. What are you going to tell me?" And I found myself dealing with two different cultural transitions right in the same class. That's very helpful. Mike?
I did an internship in Denver, Colorado, at a very strange OB church because it ministers both blacks and whites and Hispanics in that culture. But I found that the distinctions between black and white culture in that church were not as pronounced as they are out in Philadelphia. It seems that as a whole, the black community out there was in a different place. And I found in the church there seemed to be a polarization towards the center position. Does that often happen in mixed churches? Or because that has two particular kinds of problems. And doing, you never know when you're going to hit it, or when, for example, some of the college-educated black people in the church, if you tried to talk in a more black cultural way, would be very insulted. Is that true of other churches, or is it just a strange situation?
I guess my experience in Philly, number one, is you will very rarely find churches that are, quote, integrated. In my particular neighborhood, in a period of a year or two after we first moved in, we visited over 30 churches. Of the 32 churches we visited, only two we felt were integrated. But the element of integration, nothing to do with ethnicity or race. I think those birds are very rare birds. That's my experience. And when it does happen, what you look for are things that where people are drawn together, not necessarily people who are drawn together, and part of the reason they're drawn together is because all the groups involved don't particularly think that that race, etc., is that major question. One congregation I visited in Philadelphia, for example, I noticed on a Sunday morning worship had a extremely large number of, quote, mixed marriages. That is where where you had black-white marriages. And what I guessed was, here was a church where those kinds of folks were finding companionship, they were finding openness, and so they're being drawn to that church because those needs were being met.
And they're not accepted in either the black or the white church.
Right. The part of the struggle, I think, is in terms of looking for, quote, a culture or things that draw people together. You're not looking for necessarily for ethnic things that people hold in common. In a city, for example, much more than ethnicity, people build other kinds of networks. And those other socializing networks may be the things that pull people together, much more than the fact that this person's Italian, that person's Polish, and this guy over here is purple. They come together because of different reasons. And so you look for the things that are bringing those people together and then wrestle with how to make use of that for the gospel. Any other experiences in this area? Jim?
Chicago the same way. Seems like the integration happens as you move up in terms of class. And the lower the class situation, the greater the degree of segregation. although the black churches are much more open to having whites as being a part of the black church than the white churches and the lower income levels.
Yeah.
So I find it class more than race and ethnic. I think the classism problem is probably one of the greater problems.
Yeah, that's helpful, Jim. What? How about Italy? Any experiences there that fit along this line now, Mel?
Oh, you guys
are a big help, you know?
I'm afraid you wouldn't be able to understand the culture.
Okay.
We had a hard problem with barbecue because the spaghetti kept falling
through the rear. Well, these are some of these cultural crises you go through.
We have a... Yeah, here we go into a situation in Taiji. You think the culture's the same, but where we work in Milan, there is it's almost like a black-white difference between the northern Italians and the southern. Southerns are considered like maybe the blacks would be here.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, most of in Milan, there are basically there's a northern church and a southern church.
Uh-huh.
And doesn't seem to be working well when there's a mixture of the two. In our church, we have a mixture, and from high class and low class, it's kind of unique. But it's in other churches, it's don't mix the two.
Yeah.
During the 60s, when there was industrial boom in Italy, there was a mass movement from the south to the north for jobs. And I have seen rental signs for rooms. Room for rent, no Southerners wanted. Put it out there. And the Southerner has moved into the city of Turin, for example, which is the Detroit of Italy. And there are more Southerners there now than there are Piedmontese, as they call them, people, which frightens the Northerner considerably. And of course, the Mafia has moved in at the same time with the movement up there. Not only that, but they have a strange policy of moving mafia prisoners into northern prisons and communities, which really sets the northerner, really off his rocker. You know, just can't handle it. And because northern Italy really supports southern Italy financially and economically, they pour money down there, and of course they never know where it goes because once it gets below Naples, why it's goodbye.
Being poured into the thin spaghetti market.
Is it true that the Mafia are trying to muscle in the thick spaghetti?
Kevin, thank you.
When I was in New York City with InterVarsity, one of the things I noticed was I thought I'd be visiting a black church. So I went to one of my friend's churches, another student, and I was at a black church. And everybody there was black, and I was the only white person. And everybody there was black. But the people in one church were all from Jamaica, and the people in the other church were from Panama. Then I found another church that was Trinidad. Another church, North Carolina. And so we as whites look at the black community like, well, that's the black community. Everybody that's in that's black is going to go to the black church.
Yeah.
And it's a very much more filtered thing than that.
Yeah, yeah. They all look the same to us, right?
Yeah.
The Presbyterians look like Italians, all the same.
Yeah, right.
I'll create our grids.
Mike.
Oh. Came off the cliff. Praise the Lord. That's Oh yes, Patrick.
Well, in terms of. I think what I'm hearing us all say, with enough illustrations from all over the place, is that communication, to be effective, has got to be aware of the different cultures to which we go. And those cultures shape our language, they must also shape by their very nature the way we present the gospel. Now, without getting into this in heavy detail, I think I want to at least stick on here in 5 minutes a theological justification for this process. And I hope nobody's taking notes. I want to remind you that I think the easiest way to do it is to remind you of a basic proposition that I think fits, and that using I introduce some of the communication language. Sometimes a term like communicators use. So we let C stand for communicator, M is message, R for receptor. Put it this way, that revelation is receptor-oriented. Now, that may create some waves and ripples, because I suspect the impression left on most of you by this stage is that revelation is message-oriented. I don't think that's biblical. I think a message, of course, is of great importance. But even message is directly related to this issue. For example, I think here is where the concept of biblical theology can help you. Biblical theology, as you should know by now, is the history of special revelation. Now, why does special revelation have a history? Why does God bother with this whole process of sort of step-by-step unveiling his will through the structures of time to his people? And I think the answer to that question is because God is receptor-oriented. And the very nature or character of biblical theology ought to remind you that very strongly. That the Lord is so concerned that his word be given to his people, that he constructs the giving of that word in terms of the ability of his people in space and time to hear it and move with it. So he doesn't give Adam in the garden a shopping list of all of the names that he should now memorize, like Bethlehem. Have you heard of Bethlehem, Adam? Adam, have you heard of Micah? Memorize that, Adam. the Lord doesn't do that. Rather, his word, though given to Adam, is appropriate. It is a word that underlines the fact that God is going to save, and God is going to save through conflict, out of which the seed of the woman will emerge victorious. All of that is sufficient for Adam, and all of that is oriented to what Adam needed to know at that particular time. All right, that just simply says the very character of revelation is itself receptor-oriented. Now, I think another sample of this same kind of orientation comes, for example, with things we have in the scriptures that the theologians call anthropomorphisms. The Lord's hand is not shortened that it cannot save. The prayers of the Lord's people are a sweet-smelling incense, that comes before the nostrils of the Lord. The Lord walked to and fro in the garden in the cool of the day. Does the Lord have a nose? Does the Lord have a short hand? Does the Lord have 2 feet that walk in gardens? And the answer all of us know is, of course not. These are all analogies. And why the analogies? So that human beings in our finiteness, in our creatureliness, can grasp something of the greatness of God, but we have to grasp it in terms of our categories. And God is willing to use our categories to communicate himself to us. Now that just says, I think, that revelation itself is oriented to the receptor. Any questions so far? Boy, this is great. Mike?
Where does the normativity come in?
I think normativity comes in several areas, but if you want to hang on to that, we'll get at it. because it's tied in with the whole question of what you mean by meaning. In any case, I think this gets underlined over and over again in different ways. The very nature of the revelation of God is oriented towards the receiver. In Gerhardus Voss, it has a little book on Hebrews, in his little book on Hebrews, he makes a reference to Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 and 2, you know, that passage about God speaking. And he comments that the word that's used there in Hebrews 1, verses 1 and 2 for speak is not the traditional word lego, it is the word laleo. And whether rightly or wrongly, but it makes a great preaching point, Voss comments that that word laleo was used in street Greek. It is an onomopoetic term, and it is used to describe baby talk. You know, the la-la, ma-ma, da-da. All right, there's laleo. And the point he makes, I think, is a beautiful one. That not only is Hebrews 1, verses 1 and 2, describing God speaking, revealing his word throughout human history, but what it's underlining is that God's willing to baby talk with his creation so that they can be sure to understand it. That is how far the Lord is willing to go to communicate with the receptors of his word. Now, I say all of this because my general frustration with the theological school, from which you will now soon graduate, is that they are all very heavily oriented to this. The second greatest place where you get a lot of attention is here, on the communicator. You get relatively little information, if any, on the receptor. So, as a result, the focus in a school like Westminster is how to talk, right? And all the courses are designed that way. It's like wrapping presents. In Old Testament and New Testament, you learn which presents to wrap, which text to work out of. Church history tells you all of the times throughout human history when the packages have been wrapped in the wrong way. Apologetics tells you what happens when somebody tries to steal your package. Practical theology tells you how to wrap. But the whole emphasis is on the gift, with relatively little emphasis on the one who's going to receive the gift. So, for example, we don't have any courses at Westminster Seminary in teaching how to listen. Almost all the courses are designed to teach you how to talk. Courses in preaching, practice preaching. You know, there's not a course anywhere in sight on practice listening. And though it might be a very good idea. Counseling would come close. But I'll watch out, but I'll say it anyway. One of the dangers of the nuthetic counseling model is that it minimizes the listening, I think, and emphasizes the nuthetizing, so the confrontation, so that again the model itself focuses on the verbalizing. I think by contrast, there is something to learn from a Rogers method, and one of the things you learn from it is how to listen. Now that'll get me fired. But it's all great stuff, and you'll... Anyway, I do think, though, this works generally across the boards. And as a result, it creates problems, because we have not developed skills in how to listen to others. And as a result of that, what can go wrong is that message we're trying to communicate, because we haven't stopped long enough to hear where people are coming from to know what to say. The Lord, they're just places, you know, where when you, one of, again, this is, I think, the beauty of biblical theology, because it recognizes, coordinating with that, the whole idea of the progress of revelation. There's a progressiveness to revelation. And the Lord, in the old dispensation with divorce, allowed certain things because that was all the people could take then. But then along comes the Lord and puts the clamps down on certain things that were allowed even in the Old Testament and tightens up other things even more. So that you can see God, as it were, opening up more of his word to his people, making those adjustments in terms of what people were willing to were able to grab hold of. Just to my mind fits in the very nature and character of how God talks to us, and surely that's got to be a model about how we talk to others. I think one of the big dangers that a lot of you are going to struggle with as soon as you get out of here is that, you've been storing it up for 3 years. You've got 3 years of talk, that you're ready to explode on the world. And all you've been doing is just, filling out those little exams and reading all those books. And it's been going on for years now, hasn't it? And you've been soaking it all up. And suddenly, they're going to spring the gate and you can walk out of here a free person. Your debts are paid and you're ready to go. So you hit your first church and you're going to explode. You're going to verbalize till the cows come home and the church leaves. Unless you've got a very wise group of elders or pastors or friends who are going to tell you after about 2 to 3 months, to clamp down a little bit. Because you go on like gangbusters. You've got so much to say. You've reversed the whole process. You're moving into a brand new situation when you don't know what's there. That's the time when you've got to listen, and listen very, very carefully. But it's tough. Arthur?
Those books you recommended, did they give us any instruction?
Yeah, I think so. Just in terms of some of the things they suggest, I think Kraft particularly has a lot of practical stuff in this area. I think there are a lot of things to learn just by reading secular communication books. Because they focus a great deal on this whole question of how to listen to people. I'm also impressed by the fact, hey, the Lord was a great listener. Not only did God does God speak, he also listens. Please, Jim.
Yeah, I guess I'm changing the subject a little bit. What does this model do then to our hermeneutic? Does this indicate that the hermeneutic then we come out of on this rather than the kind of exegesis that we have been doing, which is so message-oriented to get down to all the minutiae of the message, is to say what I have to do is start interpreting the word through the eyes of the individuals who I am trying to minister to, and getting inside of the receptor's mindset and worldview and coming back at the scripture from that standpoint. Is that changing the focus of our hermeneutic a great deal?
With some, maybe 100-degree turn. I'm daydreaming here, but it strikes me that in a real sense, this is part of the essence of what gospel communication has always been. And what putting a sermon together means. It means getting inside that congregation's head, being able to see where they're at on that particular day, and then to be able to move them out of there and show them that there's something here in this text that comes from God that's extremely helpful and encouraging or challenging for them on this day. A lot of things can go haywire in the process, but it seems to me that's the classic kind of way of putting all this together. One of the problems, I think, that frustrates me in this area is, we may get into this someday, is the easy way in which we divide sermons up between exegesis and application. The more I think about those distinctions, their value, I think, is on a kind of a learning basis when you're just getting started. And the fact, you've got to, people are just learning that their books called commentaries, and you've got to somehow or other make use of these things. So from that point of view, that distinction is helpful. But from another point of view, I find it very frustrating, because it makes, to my mind, what ultimately is an artificial division between exegesis and application in such a way that you can sort of almost do one without the other. And John Bettler, who teaches preaching around here, said, we're talking one day, and John said, we were talking about how much time you put in on sermons and where you divide the time. John said that he spent about as much time in working through the application of a message as he does with the exegesis. I think that's quite true. And I would say around here, at this particular stage of some of your growth, you probably spend about 90% of your time on exegesis, and 10%, if even that, on how to apply it. I think that is a deadly mistake. But it's sort of, I find a lot of times, just in from a practical point of view, in preaching, for example, that the key to my being able to put things together in terms of the text and application is always the introduction. What am I going to try to say? What do I want the Lord's people to do as a result of listening to this message? What is the particular problem or struggle they're going through that I want to address now? And in the introduction, I want them to see what I consider their problem or struggle to be. So I'll lay it out in the introduction. I may lay it out through an illustration, through anything that will grab their attention, but something that will say to them that a person sitting down there in that pew will listen to me and say, hey, he's saying something maybe I ought to hear. He's talking about something that's a struggle for me. Then when I'm sure that I've got that person, then I'll take them through the exegesis. But I'll take them through the exegesis in terms of the struggle. And when I come to the conclusion, I'm going right back to the introduction again, and then I'm going to say, now listen, this is what I wanted to grab your attention for. Now this is what I want you to do with it. And then I begin to struggle. So that in a real sense, I don't make those divisions of exegesis and application. They all start flowing together. And I think that's part of being oriented to the receptor. Does that make sense to you, Jim?
Because, you know, as we try to teach homiletics, we often put application down the road, and contextualization is more than application.
Yeah.
It seems to me that it is the process of interpretation from the perspective of the person you're trying to reach.
Right.
Therefore, there is that integration then right away, because they realize you understand the word in their framework. It's not that I just come up with some neat application so that they say, hey, I know where you live.
Right.
It's, no, I know not only where you live, but I'm living where you live, and therefore I'm trying to view the scriptures from where you live.
Yeah.
And that's a lot different in our methodology, it seems, than what we're focused on. Because we always do our exegesis over here, and then we try to figure out, okay, how do we apply that?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And somehow we've got to change that perspective in terms of exegesis.
Just one hint and let you loose here. I have found that some of this has changed my sermon preparing habits. I don't begin my exegesis until I get some idea of the problem I want to deal with in the pulpit, or the thing I want to do, the assurances maybe I want to give the Lord's people. And after I've got it set out in my own mind where I'm going to go, then I start looking at the exegesis. Because then what you're doing is you're looking at that exegesis, and that problem is, or that question is rooted right there as you look at the scriptures. Going to dominate, it's going to filter. It obviously is. But that's why you can preach more than one sermon on the same text in your life and never hit the same base twice. well, we better quit and we'll come back.